to the Intelligence Hour, cutting-edge expose of the actions of government in the light of the U.S. Constitution. I am Bill Miker, your guest host for Kevin Shipp's Intelligence Hour, and my pleasure to introduce our guest tonight, Mr. Bruce Aitken. As always, Kevin likes to introduce the program with these questions. Do we live under a post-constitutional government? Is there really a shadow government? A massive system controlled by secrecy or deep state that controls Washington, D.C. behind the scenes? Why does it seem like congressional hearings on government corruption never go anywhere? Why do government officials and the heads of major Wall Street corporations commit crimes and lie under oath, but they are never seemingly charged, while Americans or other citizens of lesser status are hit with maximum penalties? Why do congressmen and senators from both parties promise their voters peace and solutions to their financial crisis, then vote for billion-dollar wars, foreign coups, and covert programs that violate international law and human rights? Why does it seem that the national media doesn't report on these stories or merely parrot the stories put out by the government? These are the type of issues we deal with on the Intelligence Hour, and we have no conservative or liberal bias, no Republican or Democratic influence. We simply don't go down that path, and we choose to put out the information as we know it so people can make their own decisions. The Intelligence Hour has one goal, and that is to fulfill the constitutional responsibility to inform you, primarily the American people, our audience, about the actions of government. You are the voice of government by the people. You are the solution to restoring freedom, peace, and justice in the United States. And so for that reason, we put this show together and we bring on guests such as Bruce Aitken and others to share their thoughts and their experiences to create a better informed population. So sit back, relax, and join me for a fascinating discussion on both the current state of government today, considered against the backdrop of the what we believe is the greatest governing document ever written, and that is the United States Constitution. So tonight we have as our guest Mr. Bruce Aitken. Bruce is somebody that I've met here in Hong Kong. He's a pretty extraordinarily experienced individual who's shoved several lifetimes into his life. From humble beginnings in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, Bruce Aitken was destined to be a baseball player until fate stepped in the form of a knee injury and forever changed the course of his life. What started innocently enough, answering an ad in the newspaper, turned into a globe-trotting lifestyle of moving money, huge sums of money, for some of the world's most notorious and somewhat shady characters. From the jungles of Vietnam to the money capitals of the world, Bruce moved in circles that would unquestioningly hand over millions of dollars to him on a handshake to be deposited into Swiss bank accounts. It all started to crash via an event in Reno, Nevada, and nearly cost Bruce the rest of his life in prison. Bruce, interestingly enough, has written a book called The Cleaner, the true story of one of the world's most successful money launderers. What I find amusing about it is that the foreword was written by a chap by the name of Howard Marks, also known as Mr. Nice. When I first joined the Mounted Police in the mid-80s, I had heard about this individual named Howard Marks. He was at the time considered probably the world's most successful smuggler of hashish and marijuana from Pakistan, the Golden Crescent, into North America. So Bruce has certainly met a cadre of interesting individuals. And more importantly, Bruce has had a recent transaction on where we are today, because during the Kavanaugh hearings, Christine Blasey Ford came forward with the allegations against Mr. Kavanaugh. Against the backdrop of that, there was some media pundits who alleged that Ms. Blasey Ford had connections to a very experienced senior former OSS CIA officer by the name of Nicholas Deeks, who is considered by many as the James Bond of banking. And as it happens, our guest, Bruce Aitken, his mentor was none other than Nicholas Deeks. So maybe that's a good place to begin, Bruce. First question, a simple one. Were you aware that Nicholas Deeks had a granddaughter by the name of Miss Blasey Ford?
It's a good question to start out with, Bill. And the list of questions that you presented for the Intelligence Hour, all the whys too, are a very, very interesting mandate. So it's a real pleasure to be on the program tonight. I believe we're living in a very Orwellian world, and the situation with Mr. Deke. I mean, all things seem to be possible, but from my knowledge of Mr. Deke, he had one son, Leslie Deke, and given the age differences, I think. Blasey is probably about 58. I would say Leslie is probably about 70. So I doubt if he could have had a daughter. that would Nicholas Deeke would then have a granddaughter by her name. So I think that's a little bit far out.
Okay, but so Bruce, let's talk about really what you do know and your life. Again, it's fascinating, and we will talk a little bit about your book, The Cleaner, because what's
Thanks.
amazing about it is that it's your life and it's an amazing story.
Oh, thank you. Thank
You
you.
know, you started in the late 1960s by answering an ad in the newspaper in the United States for American Express looking for somebody to go to a place called Vietnam. Perhaps you could
Right.
start there and tell us about how you entered this world of money laundering, initially
Okay.
on behalf of American corporations, then on behalf of American intelligence agencies, and then on behalf of everybody else who came through your doors, and along the way touched on some of the most seminal events in terms of American history, dealing with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and dealing with regime change of various governments around the world, partly assisted by your efforts in laundering money.
Okay, I think that is a good place to start. Anybody who is born with a certain vocation, I think these people are very lucky or an ability. I had always hoped and I thought I would be a professional baseball player, and I was well on my way until a knee injury intervened. And I was actually protesting the war in Vietnam and probably listening to Bob Dylan in those late 60s and advocating peace. But then I got a job with American Express International Banking Corporation, and I got assigned to Vietnam. So I said, well, this is my chance to go and have a look and see what's really going on there. So I arrived in Saigon in 1969, and I was introduced almost immediately to what's called the free market or the black market. For example, in those days, as a bank manager, I could take 100 MPC, which was military payment certificates. It looks like monopoly money. I could exchange that in my own bank for 100 US dollar green, real US dollar, $100 bill. Now I could go down to Saigon to the Astor Hotel and see my number one Chinese money changer, Mr. Tai, and he would take that 100 green and give me 200 MPC. So I, in effect, doubled my money. I could go back to my bank at American Express with the 200 MPC, turn that into 200 green, and go back and see Mr. Tai and turn that 200 green back into 400 MPC, if you follow me so far. So I sort of felt like I was the Fed creating money out of thin air, and I guess I was hooked. But after a couple of years in Vietnam doing this, I was cautious because I didn't want to get too much involved, and I knew it was against the regulations. But by fate, I went to Hong Kong then in 1971, and I happened to join a company called Deke and Company, and this really changed my life because, as it turned out, Deke was sort of like the Rolls-Royce and the Cadillac of money laundering companies rolled into one. But it was a different environment in those days. For example, there weren't money laundering laws. It hadn't come into existence yet, really. So what we were doing instead, we called it circumventing foreign exchange controls or foreign exchange regulations. And if you recall, in those days, all of the countries around this area had foreign exchange regulations. So some of them, like in the Philippines, for example, if a Filipino wanted to buy stocks in New York, he couldn't do it. He couldn't get the money through US dollars through the Central Bank of the Philippines without a big hassle. But with Deke, we provided the facilities. We'd buy his pesos and give him US dollars instantly. So actually, we did a lot of commercial business like that all around the area. But The thing is, in those days, Deke's motto was have cash, call Deke, no questions asked. Mr. Deke had hired me in New York. He was an amazing man, very charismatic, spoke many languages. He came from Hungary and became a U.S. citizen in the 30s, I guess, and joined the U.S. Army during the war and became a major almost right away. And he was the officer in charge who took the Japanese flag of surrender in Burma. And after his military stint, he joined was a forerunner, actually, and joined the OSS, which is the Office of Strategic Services. I think that was started by Wild Bill Donovan many years ago, and it was the forerunner of the CIA. So Mr. Deke traveled in very, very interesting circles, and he saw ways to move money surreptitiously all over the world. Our motto was privacy is most important. Have cash, call Deke, no questions asked. Of course, When this is know your client, you know, KYC is no questions asked. You're subject to running into all kinds of characters that maybe perhaps you should have done a little bit more due diligence to find out what their background was. But I joined Deke, and it opened up a world of intrigue because Deke had methods to move money all over the world, and some were by what we call out here hundi or swaps, where on a telephone call you could buy and sell the local currencies. But we often didn't have those systems, and instead we used other methods that Deke created and another fellow out here, a very charismatic manager of Deke and Company Far East named Dirk Brink. He had a very clever mind for ways to move money. But one way, for example, was very, very basic and simple. When we didn't have any method, then we actually had very, very specially made golf bags that could hold about $500,000 in different currencies. And, well, to make a long story short, we had golf bags going all over the world filled with currencies, and they were never, ever checked in those days because it was a very, very different world. But what happened?
I would say, Bruce, I wouldn't say it's changed that much because, you know, there's still cash moving across borders in many forms and fashion without there being a lot of a checking being done. And for That's the benefit of the audience, you know, there are three ways typically that money is laundered. In physical form, which is what you were doing a lot of, right. You know, cash. But people forget cash is heavy, it's bulky, and which makes it problematic. The second way is moving money through wire transfers through banks and banking instruments. The problem with that is that banks now have a lot more surveillance on them. There's a lot more technical surveillance and means to try to capture it. And then the third way of moving money, which I believe is by far the greatest way of doing it, is through trade finance. But invariably, the only thing that changes between those who want to launder money or disguise the origin of the money or legitimate money that they want to use for an illicit purpose is through layering it, through working through people such as yourself at that point in time who didn't ask the questions about know your client or source of funds. You just undertook a contract to move money from A to B or to disguise it in a way that didn't create a tax liability for yourselves or for others.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Nothing world today has really changed. The only thing that has changed is technology, but the motivations behind why people do what they do and why they launder money hasn't changed at all. So as much as the world 30 years ago, 40 years ago, was much more cash-based, it is no different 40 years ago than it is today in terms of motivations and the reasons why people want to disguise the origin or the use of that money. I apologize. I just wanted the audience to know that you know what you're talking about. It's a little more sophisticated in terms of how people are moving the money, but the fundamental principles are the same.
I fully agree, Bill, and I appreciate you pointing that out. In fact, using Hong Kong and China and the border here, for example, I'm sure a lot of cash just comes right across the border from Shenzhen into Hong Kong. So I fully agree with you. And different cities from China, I hear a lot of cash is actually smuggled out.
Yeah, no, for sure. And what I find really interesting about your experience with Mr. Deeks is when I was a young Mountie, I had an informant, and this informant came out of the financial markets, and that was the first time I heard Nicholas Deeks' name, and he was presented to me as the individual who is really the father of modern money laundering. As the person who took it and made money laundering a facet of government policy, a facet and a tool for regime change. And I was referenced to when the Shah of Iran took over in Iran in the early 50s, the money that was used to facilitate that regime change was done by Mr. Deeks on behalf of, at that point, the CIA. I'm curious if Mr. Deeks ever spoke of that with you, or whether in the years that you were with Mr. Deeks, did you come across government agencies that, you know, with a wink-wink and a nod, had you engaged in moving money for basically regime change or for government entities to do what they wanted to do under the guise of secrecy?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I did. Going back a little bit, another example of the history, I don't remember the exact date, but there was a date way back, I guess it's in the 50s or so, when China was actually building up a lot of troops along the border with India. And what alerted America to this was the fact that Indian rupees were being bought up like crazy in Hong Kong by the Chinese military. And so the currency was what actually gave a little indication that they were thinking of invading at that time, although the year, escapes me. But dealing with Deke here in Hong Kong and Dirk Brink, the charismatic manager, we had contacts with the U.S. consulate here, and they would use our services as well. Come in and ask us to make payments all over Korea, for example. I made payments myself to Korean generals in cash. But the one that really stuck out was cash that I would smuggle, actually, from Guam to Tokyo quite often, about once a month, about $500,000 in Japanese yen. And I would give it to our agent there. Now, the order came from the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong. I presumed it was a CIA order. And the money, actually, I would pay to Father Jose Galliano. Our agent was a Spanish priest. Father, I thought it was pretty good karma then. The order comes from the U.S. government. Our agent was a priest. I'd have a nice lunch with Father Jose at the Los Platos Hotel in Tokyo. Off he would go with the money. But he would give that money then to someone else, who gave it to someone else. Finally, the last someone else was the Prime Minister Tanaka. So not knowing your client really blew up in a big way. It became the Lockheed scandal because all of the money was a payment as bribes to Tanaka and his group. And this led to Frank Church, a congressman, to institute what became the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, where it became illegal to bribe foreign officials and foreign governments. So this is one major example, and there are many other minor ones where we made payments for the U.S. consulate quite often, and nothing ever became of it, no questions asked. Yeah, except I must say in Korea, a couple of times there, I would actually pay to a Korean general in cash $100,000 at a time, and I think it was probably for some a military handout or whatever you'd call it.
So you were never passing on information. You were simply being a good citizen and doing what your government asked of you to move money around. And but you were never giving instructions to people. You were merely being a courier of cash. Would that be accurate?
That's accurate. That's correct. It was simply, that's it, 100%.
Well, you know, what's interesting is because being involved in banking, you know, the FCPA or the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is something that is a very heavy tool that is wielded by U.S. prosecutors, U.S. Department of Justice, when it suits them. And the irony is that, you know, it started by actions that were precipitated by the U.S. government itself. I mean, from 1969 to 1975, Deakin Company was the conduit used by Lockheed Corporation to transfer money intended by Lockheed to bribe Japanese officials. And the reason for this is you had Japan Airlines, ANA, All Nippon Airways. They were looking at buying aircraft, a lot of aircraft, and Lockheed Martin, as well as some of the other American contractors, which I think is fair to say are part of the U.S. military industrial complex, didn't want to lose the opportunity to be selling their aircraft in volume to Japan, which was a rising economy. And so Deakin Company, and you specifically, were tasked with ensuring that money was moving into Japan to pay the bribes to the government officials that would ensure that American corporations were in the game in terms of selling, at that point in time, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aircraft. And that became known as the scandal brought in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act today.
Yes, that's correct. The interesting antidote is the competition for the Lockheed aircraft that actually won by ANA, which was by far the long shot. It was an absolute shock to Boeing and McDonnell Douglas because they were the forerunners, and ANA didn't seem even to have a chance. So it was a competition between the three American companies for the aircraft order, and it went to Lockheed, much to the shock of everybody at the time.
Well, you know, that's an amazing story because, again, it ties into the FCPA, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. We see the double standards applied by those who are either in favor or out of favor with the corporate America or the political directives of America, either at that time or today. But it was more than that. You were involved in more than that. Maybe you can tell the audience a bit about the Nugent Hand affair. And go into the backdrop of these individuals and again, your role there, because, again, it doesn't paint a very nice picture of what happens when government agencies can hide behind secrecy, can hide behind the ability to shut down bad news when things go wrong. And yet, along the way, it is horribly corruptive and corrosive, both for government agencies as well as the public, who expects better from their security services.
Yes, indeed. I couldn't agree with you more. Nugent Hand was a major fiasco that took place in the 80s, quite suddenly. You know, Deke had run into trouble, and actually, very unfortunately, he himself was murdered in 1984. His company had run into financial difficulties, overextended in gold. But before that happened, and they were facing, some of Deke's companies were facing bankruptcy. Here in Hong Kong, a new sort of organization cropped up out of nowhere called Nugent Hand Bank. And they were paying huge rates of interest over and above the market. And they were asking us to launder a lot of money out of Australia. Now, Frank Nugent and Mike Hand, the two individuals, came to our office many times. I met them and Dirk Brink met them. Mike Hand was a very highly decorated Vietnam veteran. Frank Nugent was a solicitor from Brisbane. They had intelligent contacts through Nugent's business and Mike Hand's wonderful records in Vietnam. He was a decorated hero. So they ran into people with the CIA and they started a bank. It was called Nugent Hand Bank. And Mike Hand's objective was to make this the bank for the CIA. What was telling, though, after they were here for about a year or two, getting a lot of money on deposit, they opened an office in Chiang Mai, which was very, very strange. And actually that affected the way a lot of people would look at them about doing business. But to make a long story short, they were doing a lot of funny business for the CIA. Deke had an account, which is in my book, The Methods, there with ANZ Bank at the corner of Pitt and Hunter. This is our laundering facility. To make a long story short, because time is of importance, we would deposit large amounts of cash, Australian dollars into cash, into this bank account quite often, once or twice a month, 500,000 or even more. And the bank thought the money was repatriated Australian dollars coming from Hong Kong, because Deke's offices around the world would collect Australian dollars here, courier them. We would courier them, supposedly, to Sydney and go to the bank and deposit them. And we would get Reserve Bank exchange approval for U.S. dollars. However, the money came from either Sydney or from our agents in Melbourne. It was disguised and wrapped like it came from Hong Kong. And we'd walk into the bank and they'd welcome us, another a courier arriving with money from Hong Kong, and give us the foreign exchange. So this is the way it was done. So Nguyen Han knew about us. Deke was very well known. They started using our facilities. But once Deke ran into trouble, Nguyen Han started stealing Deke's most of the foreign staff to work with them too. They paid very high commissions and all of that. I had met them many times. They had every Friday, they had like a cocktail party at their office with a lot of military people came in. And I looked at it and it reminded me of Vietnam Old Boys Network that I saw there. You know, in Vietnam, I saw a lot of corruption in the PX system, goods going out left and right, cash. It was huge corruption there in business. So I saw this old boy network. My initial feeling was to stay away from it. I felt if you got involved with these people, you'd have a hard time getting out of it. So I avoided Nguyen Han like the plague, but I saw Deke launder a lot of money for them. Deke was charging maybe 5%. I think Nguyen Han was charging their clients 15%, and they had more money to launder than Deke could even handle through our bank account. So that was about the extent of my relationship with them. But Deke had other methods for moving money, even out of America. We could move out of, you know, $1 million out of America at one time, very surreptitiously by sleight of hand. And that's the methods, I think, they are in my book, too, which are quite interesting. Overall, I met a lot of characters. I met a lot of marijuana smugglers from Australia. One was called the Cessna Milner Affair, which blew up. There were two smugglers there. I knew them well. They were former D clients who I inherited when I started my own company, First Financial Services. I guess after I found out what they were doing, I continued to do business with them at the time. They more or less became friends. I didn't think at that time it was such a big deal. So I kept on laundering their money as well. They got caught and were arrested one time in Sydney then. And it looked like it was a serious case. They had about 100,000 Buddha sticks and whatever. Anyway, it went to they had a good lawyer by the name of Morgan Ryan. And to make a long story short, at the date of the hearing, it was miraculously, the case was miraculously switched to a magistrate court at that morning with no recording equipment. And they basically got off with a slap of a wrist on their wrists. But of course, prior to that, on the instructions of Milner and Cessna, I had made payments to their lawyers and to Ray Cessna, a total of about $70,000, which that helped, if you know what I mean. So this is going on all the time, all kinds of scandals and all kinds of payments being made to hide things or to change things. And, you know, I guess the world is still pretty much the same today.
No, I think it is. And not to go over it again, for the sake of the audience, you know, mm-hmm. Mr. Deke was an amazing individual, and I wish I had the opportunity to meet him. Yes. You know, with all of his intellect and his talents, his courage during the war mm-hmm. years, you know, fighting right. in a Cold War, you know, he had built up the United States' largest non-bank dealer in currency and precious metals. Mm-hmm. No easy achievement. And I think it's fair to say, you know, I don't want people to think we're coming on strong, that everything that governments do in the name of secrecy is necessarily bad, because I don't believe that is the case. I believe mm-hmm. mistakes get buried because you can hide behind secrecy. But mm-hmm. from my personal career, there were times where we needed to rely on people like Mr. Deeks, who came out of the community. And then they're now out in the broader milieu, and there's only so many people that you can trust with government secrets, that we have to move money to for an operation somewhere, need to move money because we need to relocate people who have helped our country or helped our operations. We need to be able to move money to pay informants. And so there's a need, a legitimate need in securing the safety of your citizens, of your country and your allies to be able to operate, if you will, in plain sight without being seen that you are facilitating something a little deeper. So, my question to you, notwithstanding and we'll get into it a bit, the criminal money laundering that you facilitated and did, do you believe, when you look back at what you did for the American government in Vietnam, for what you did with Deeks on behalf of these different agencies, do you recognize that sometimes governments are forced to do bad things to meet a better objective, or do you believe that doing bad things, no matter how noble the purpose, is wrong? I mean, do you see pluses and minuses in what you did in your career?
I see your point, and it's a very good point. And I think that would be a judgment question, I think, based on each transaction. But I think, the strength of Mr. Deeks' philosophy that he impregnated into us was the right of privacy. This was so important to him. That's why when the Lockheed scandal blew up and he was called before Congress and I think the Church Commission, whatever, he said, "We are not policemen. We are not doing the policeman's job." And that was pretty much his constant statement. He didn't want, it wasn't that he was not, didn't want to cooperate, because he felt, I'm sure, a lot of the times that he was asked to do things, it was probably for legitimate government operation reasons, for example, where cash needed to be moved in, maybe for, perhaps a good reason. If, as you say, that I could imagine there would be cases where cash was needed to actually try to apprehend or entice someone into a situation where you could apprehend a serious criminal. So I guess that would be something that would be acceptable. But Mr. Deke, I think, avoided it all by his philosophy of saying, "I absolutely will not ask any questions. Under the auspices of privacy is everything to me. And if something is being done by the authorities, that's their business. But we won't touch it. We just follow this simple philosophy. And that's it. That was really the bottom line."
Yeah, I mean, I understand the point. I think that's a cop-out, though, because, I've heard that the former head of the Canadian Bankers Association, when Canada was instituting money laundering legislation, said that, it is not the job of the banks to investigate our clients or where the money comes from. And to that, I would remind them that, your government and your population give you a license to print money effectively as a banker. And when there's a disaster, it's the taxpayer that bails you out. So, yes, you as part of the financial platform and framework have an obligation to ensure that the money you're bringing in is not killing our children because it's the proceeds of drug trafficking. That it's not furthering some terrorist event because you don't care where the money comes from. So, again, I understand the right for people to have some degree of privacy, but I also think that there's an obligation and a responsibility that there has to be some modicum of screening on who is your clients and what is the money that's moving. But again, I don't want to get too off topic.
Sure, I see your point as well.
But I think where did it start to go down the tubes for you guys? When you were with Deeks, and it really goes into, again, where everything crosses over. Where again, you believe you might be doing something for a noble cause, but it doesn't take long before the white knight becomes the black knight, and it wasn't long before. You guys were moving money tied into Iran-Contra, into the Nicaraguan rebels, money that was coming in, Gary Webb, had done a lot of expose, the journalist out of California, as to why was America suddenly flooded with all this crack cocaine and cocaine. We see in Mena, Arkansas, where the CIA had been running a secret air base that were bringing Sandinistas up ostensibly for military training, but at the same time you had rogue pilots either unwittingly or wittingly, to the knowledge of the American government, bringing cocaine up for the cartel, Colombian cartels. Tell me a bit about that, about those years, and how that eventually brought everything collapsing down on you guys.
Okay. Well, I think fortunate for me, being out here in Asia, in the Far East, my area was Asia. I mean, I would travel sometimes Africa, India to Australia, all around Asia, even to the old communist Russia and Soviet Union, sometimes in Europe. But I had absolutely no contact with Deke's operation in South America and Central America and the Middle East, where a lot of these things happen. Now, I don't have the language abilities, plus he always dealt with local people there. I did hear through the grapevine in some countries he actually moved money on the back of donkeys going over borders in South of America, over mountains into one country into the other. Probably this is money that went to cocaine and things like that. Probably his partners might have been CIA people too, or the dark government. But what happened was gold. Gold became a very amazing hot item, and Deke got onto the gold wagon in a big way. He would take deposits. A lot of the money that he laundered stayed with Deke. He had a Swiss banks, Austrian bank, and a lot of this money that he would take and on deposit at a high interest rate was put into gold. Of course, when you get overextended in anything and you're not covered by contracts or whatever, and there were a lot of big fluctuations, gold didn't always go up. They got caught very much on the wrong side of it many times trading. And actually, this is where they lost a lot of clients' money in several of their companies. One of the holding companies was still sound, but Deke had to declare bankruptcy, and then this ruined his operation completely. And this is a result of taking money maybe from South Americans like that that was not used for good purposes. You know, I'm very much against all this drug trading and things like that, particularly all of this hard drugs, cocaine, what it does to society and our people. We're on the same page of all the social things that can happen. But if I can move up to a question and a little bit of news, I think it's a little bit off subject right now, but there's been some very interesting news that came out in the last couple of days about the dark government. And if I could share a little bit of that with you right now, I'd like to, regarding 9/11.
Sure, feel free.
Okay, great. Because, you know, I've been a follower of 9/11 for a long time, since it happened, whatever. And December 10th was only a couple of days ago. You know, this news has probably come not out in the major media very much, but talk about the dark government. The grand jury investigation project was launched. It's a big breakthrough because a U.S. attorney in Manhattan agrees to present evidence of World Trade Center demolition to a federal grand jury. Now, there's a site called Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, lc4911.org. I've been following this organization for a while. They come through the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. I mean, this is dynamite, earth-shaking. It says, finally, after 17 long years, the 9/11 truth movement has opened an avenue to prosecute those responsible for the shocking destruction of the World Trade Center and the horrible loss of life that resulted. Last spring, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, together with more than a dozen 9/11 family members with the help of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, filed a position with a petition. The U.S. attorney in Manhattan demanding that he present evidence of unprosecuted federal crimes at the World Trade Center to a special grand jury. And then in November, the big news came. The U.S. attorney notified the lawyers' committee in writing that he would comply with the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 3332, requiring them to relay their report to a special grand jury. I mean, this is absolutely dynamite, because I think we're going to finally get to underneath the bottom of the truth of what happened, and not this, what I call fake news of the 9/11 commission that the government presented to the people.
I mean, to be honest, I don't have any strong view on what you just said, because I'm not that familiar with it. What I do know is, 3,000 people lost their lives. You know, it's clear towers came down. There was people who took credit for it. There was celebration in these different parts of the Islamic world for what happened. So I'm glad that people are digging in to make sure that anybody and everybody that would have had a part of that is held accountable, whether it be people don't want to hear about or otherwise. But I admit to not being as up on those facets that you just described.
Sure. I understand that's going to be okay, but I think we're going to hear a lot of it once it catches on. I don't know about the major media, but as a result of that 9/11, what happened? The consequences were unbelievable. The Patriot Act, which is a loss of civil liberties, over 1 million people have been killed. There's wars for empires, destabilization of the Middle East and Afghanistan. I think it's official cover-up, the use of torture, drones, trillions diverted to war profiteers. This is absolutely, I think it's going to be gigantic news. But the interesting thing about the what they filed with the U.S. attorney is it has 57 pieces of unrefutable evidence that goes along with it. And I'll just wind this up with one little amazing example of evidence is that, you know, you can't cover everything. And the people who did this couldn't have realized that such a blast creates seismic waves. These waves were picked up. For example, under World Trade Center number 1 was recorded on seismic waves, a huge blast 13 seconds before the first plane hit. World Trade Center 2, a huge blast 17 seconds before the second plane hit. And then you have World Trade Center number 7, which most Americans don't even know about, was a controlled demolition. So I think that, I'll go on a little bit off topic here, but I think it's something we should really watch. I think it's going to be gigantic, major news.
Well, I mean, if there's a grain of truth to what you've said there, it should be front page news, and people should demand to know what happened. I mean, I think the bigger message trying to get through is through your own experiences, where everybody is looking left while you and Deke and others are doing things on the right. Again, both for government entities, corporate America entities, and then as well just for those involved in criminal activity. It's easy to create a smoke and mirror scenario. And having lived through decades of doing this, do you see any similarities between what you did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s to what you see taking place in America today, where you have, you know, maybe it's not such a caste-based method of laundering money, but are there any red flags you're seeing in America today? And again, we're not talking about one political party or the other, but in terms of banks, corporate America, are you seeing similarities in terms of saying the right things in the public domain, but once you're outside of the public view, it is hell-bent for leather to do whatever you think is good for the American military complex, for the deep state, if you will, for America and the drive for profits? Do you see parallels?
Well, yes. You know, I've been living out of the United States for 50 years, and I think from this viewpoint of being outside and looking in, I don't think human nature has changed so much. But I'm highly highly against it all, and I believe and I support everything that can be done to sort out all of the corruption and all of the dark governmental bankers who are doing surreptitious things, money laundering. Actually, I'm quite against it all at this point in my life, because I see the corrupting influences. But I think human nature is the same, and I have a feeling that it hasn't changed at all. There's still a lot going on, if not more.
I don't think human nature has changed at all. All that's changed is the technology and the medium by which people hurt other people or take advantage of other people.
Yeah, and it's the money, you know, the money and the power. It's very corrupts, very much corrupts.
I'm curious, Bruce. Do you? I mean, you're what, 72 now, 73?
I'll be 74 in February, but still feeling pretty good.
That I'm still looking good too. So do you still get the odd inquiry from people asking if you can move money for them?
Yes, I do. I gave a talk at the Foreign Correspondents Club back in May, and it was here in Hong Kong. Yes, and it was called The True Story of a World Successful Money Launderer, Catch Me If You Can. And after the talk, and I had some people come up to me tongue in cheek and ask me if I actually knew any ways that, particularly in China, if I could help them with blocked funds in China. And I very politely asked them how much, and it was very small amounts. And I said, well, thank you very much. But even if it was large amount or small amount, I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah, no, like I said, I same thing. I mean, even with my background, I have people asking me if I can help them move money that is clearly of a dodgy origin. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how people are so focused on the objective, they don't see where all the scrutiny is coming from and how easily they can be caught just because they're almost reckless, for lack of a better word. Yes. You know, as you say, you've been out of the United States for 50 years. You're involved in moving vast sums of money around. What do you make of what's happening in the United States today? Do you believe there's a deep state? I mean, notwithstanding what we've just said, but do you believe that there's really a shadow government that is operating not with the best interests of the people, but simply trying to aggregate as much power or money as they can? Behind the disguise of working and helping government entities?
Mm-hmm. I do. I look back to what Eisenhower said during his time, and he said one of the biggest problems of the future that America will have to worry about is the military-industrial complex. And I think he hit the nail right on the head. This is a very, very powerful force. I mean, let's face it, the percentages, but the military-industrial complex is a huge employer and a huge part of the U.S. economy. And coupled with that, not only that, is what I think is a real problem in America is the power of lobbyists and lobbies. I think it's no longer government by the people, but it's government by the lobbyists. I mean, congressmen, people get elected because they take money from lobbyists who they support. And I think that this and the military-industrial complex, I think, are the two biggest detriments to government by the people and the Constitution that I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, one thing is very clear. I mean, certainly for me as an outsider, just looking at, you know, only what I know from the news, but it very clearly the I call it the legal mafia, but the lobbyists, primarily lawyers, law firms, judicial activists, they are ignoring the fact that the United States is a constitutional republic. The foundation of America is based on the Constitution. The law is based on whether it's constitutional or not. And yet you are seeing, you know, just in the last several years, an absolute shocking disregard for rule of law, for constitutional history, constitutional law. And people who were not elected are overturning the decisions of those with the executive power to follow the will of the people. If you don't like what your elected officials are doing, you can vote them out. But to have unelected officials passing and overturning or creating laws is a very frightening turn, because eventually enough of them come together to figure out we can create a legal dictatorship here.
Mm-hmm. I really worry about it. And in fact, I worry very much about the future of the America and even the present administration and the tools, the foreign policy of the country. And one of the biggest, I think, big shadows hanging over the head of America also is the fact that through its policies, it's actually alienating a lot of other people, a lot of countries in the world, too, that are looking for alternatives to the U.S. dollar. And when America loses that leverage that they have over the world, which they apply through sanctions and all kinds of other things, if they lose that, then they're going to be in big trouble.
Well, I think it's probably not going to happen in our lifetime, because the you know, what's the alternative? Is it going to be the euro? That seems to be falling apart. Is it going to be the renminbi? That's a controlled currency. It's not a free floating. So, you know, might doesn't make right, but
I'm thinking of things more like, okay, say for example, now the European Union, they want to trade with Iran. They think Iran is living up to these the nuclear deal. They would like to create an alternative system to SWIFT, for example. Well, if they're able to do that, and other countries now are starting to trade back and forth in their own currencies and bypassing the dollar.
So, yeah, no, it's an argument that's going to keep coming up, and
yeah,
I think
maybe not in our lifetime, maybe in yours, but maybe not in mine.
But I believe though that if you want to be seen as do as I do, or do as I say, then you must do as I do. And if you're saying one thing and doing another, you lose all sorts of moral and legal legitimacy.
That's true. I think it goes back to the root of the problem here with the Fed itself. I mean, shouldn't the U.S. Treasury be the one that has the right to create species and do all of this? The Federal Reserve is a private corporation controlled by bankers. It's there to their benefit to have wars, to create debt, because then they can create money, loan it out at interest, and on and on we go. Sure.
I mean, that's a whole other conversation, and I don't know, but for our audience, there's a wonderful book I've just started reading called The Creatures from Jekyll Island, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which really goes to the formation of the Federal Reserve, but it predates it by 3 years. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913, I believe, but in 1910 you had a senator from New York with some of the leading banking families who they met in Jekyll Island I believe the state of Georgia is where it was, in 1910 they realized that banks were going to be losing their position in the economy, because corporations were starting to understand that, you know, the concept of forward sales and being able to finance themselves without going to the banks based on future cash flow. And so the bankers said, hey, if these corporations realize they don't need us and all our interest and everything else, we're going to be in trouble. And so the thesis of the book goes as to why the Federal Reserve was created. It wasn't done for the well-being necessarily of the American people, but it was certainly designed and has proven to be very beneficial for the well-being of bankers and banks.
Bankers, that's right, because they can control the money supply. And I think it was the old man Rothschilds who said that. He said, give me a way to control the country's money supply, and I don't care who's in power.
No, absolutely. And so, again, I think the best people, you know, maybe look at reading that book themselves, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and I think it will give you a far greater appreciation for why are we perhaps in the mess we're in today. One of the interesting things, though, about this conversation is besides moving money, you, for most of your life, were moving a lot of gold. And there's a lot of talk now, again, about the value of gold coming back as fiat currencies become under some type of threat. There's always been voices that say, you know, we should go back to a gold standard, go back to something by which our currency is based on. You know, for 5,000 years, gold has been a stored measure of value. But you guys were moving a lot of gold as well, right? You were, in fact, I think Deeks was, if you look back on his history, it goes back to his days in the OSS coming out of the Second World War. Gold played a big part, in including, you know, his time, you know, when you go back from the 50s up into the 80s, you know, Nicholas, you know, Deeks, you know, he was dealing with Adnan Khashoggi, he was dealing with Swiss Bank Corp, you know, you have Marcos in the Philippines, all of this, and ties into, you know, people from the Trilateral Commission. And again, gold was always a big nexus of how money was moving around and with supporting different military and political regimes that found favor with the U.S. government. And, you know, there's, you know, but it goes beyond that. You know, the World Anti-Communist League, you know, everybody's talking about how bad Russia is, how bad everybody else is. But sometimes people have to stop and look in the mirror. And, and you know, the Reagan administration granted the World Anti-Communist League tax-exempt status. There are many people who believe that, you know, the U.S. government, specifically the CIA, used the World Anti-Communist League as a front in money laundering and, in fact, the drug trade, you know, to facilitate that. So I think people have to be alive to the possibility that, you know, there are two branches of government, one that you see above the waterline and then those who operate below the waterline, which is really the thesis of why Kevin Shipp became a whistleblower at the CIA and was one of the real drivers for why he created this intelligence hour to talk about the things that maybe it might be the stuff of conspiracy theory, but what if it's not? There's enough foundation and there's enough knowledge today, especially when we have the ability to take a forensic view of what happened rather than actuarial view of what's going to happen in the future. So we're able to say, well, these events did occur, and with information coming out of locked archives after 50 years or 30 years, you know, dots are connected. And I think that's really the for me anyways, the compelling story. I when I first joined government, I was pretty naive. I believed what government told me. I believed what my bosses told me. And it was only as I went further up the ladder that I started realizing perhaps everything that I was told wasn't necessarily true. So, you know, I leave it that you know, I now have a very simple axiom. You know, don't believe anything you hear and only half of what you see.
That's a good one. I think over my life, I've become a bit jaded also. I started out very naive and extremely patriotic, and I am still patriotic because I think you have to, like this Intelligence Hour, I think is a wonderful program. You have to be critical of the government and work out these things and put it on the line if you're a real patriot, in my opinion.
Agreed. So we're getting close to our hour ending here, Bruce. It was wonderful to speak with you. I think it was very enlightening for the audience to hear somebody who for decades was at the point of a very difficult and exciting life at the same time, moving money for good guys and bad guys. You paid the price for that. You and your family have suffered by the choices you've made. You're not looking for excuses. I think you've accepted that you made bad choices in life. You're doing other things now, such as you're reaching out through a missionary position of connecting families with loved ones who are sitting in prison for crimes they've committed, but that's your form of Christian outreach.
Yes, it's a bit of penance, perhaps. So I have a 15 years now. I have a radio program. It's called The Hour of Love on Metro Plus, and a big portion of it is called Prison Visitation on the Air. So I'm trying to do my best.
Okay, and appreciate that. And so I want to give you the last word here. You know, I want to encourage you, and maybe you can talk a little bit about where people could find your book, The Cleaner,
sure.
The True Story of One of the World's Most Successful Money Launderers by Bruce Aitken, Aitken, also known as Mr. Clean. I understand that the book can be found on Amazon.com.
Uh-huh. Yes, I highly recommend people buy the book on Amazon and have the whole book. I'm a bit old-fashioned. It's on Kindle as well, but I like to hold the book in my hand and, you know, and smell the pages and look at the pictures and all that. So it's on Amazon and on Kindle. It's called The Cleaner, and proceeds of the book support my radio program. So it goes for a good cause as well.
Thank you very much, Bruce, and really enjoyed having you on, and look forward to the type of questions that this conversation tonight can bear fruit with. So
thank you very much, too, Bill. I really appreciate it. You know, I think you have a most fascinating background as well. I'm really happy that our paths crossed in Hong Kong.
Likewise, Bruce. I really appreciate it, and I value your friendship.
Likewise.
So, let me close out here by saying that you can always, for the audience, give your feedback to Kevin Shipp's Facebook page from the Company of Shadows, or on his Twitter feed at Kevin_Shipp. Or you can even check out Kevin's book from the Company of Shadows on Amazon.com. If you have any questions or comments, you either directed for myself, Bill Miker, or to Kevin, please, you can email at theintelligencehour@gmail.com. So as we close out this edition of the Intelligence Hour, as always, we'd like to leave the audience with the famous quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. Have a good evening. Freedom scribbled on your